Hello and welcome to another episode of My Mortality Matters, the voices and lives of Black men. And as you know, this podcast is because of George Floyd. And I am committed to making sure that we are all aware that Black men have lives, voices, experiences, and they need to be heard and the voices need to be amplified throughout our country and definitely throughout the world. And so for me, this podcast is just my opportunity to give back to Black men, to give Black men exposure, and to give others views of who Black men are and how our lives are impacted by violence and discrimination and racism and all those things. And so today I am joined by a really, I don't know how I would describe this guy, this minister, Minister Glenn Wilson. I would describe it as a person who I have come to know through my time at Enon Baptist Church and through working at the gym every morning. He's at the gym. As a person who's very humbled and committed, and in my view, very powerful in the work that he is doing and has done in our community. And so I am delighted that he would say yes to join me in this conversation today. So please welcome Minister Glenn Wilson. Minister Wilson, how are you doing today?
Doing fine, Dr. Taylor. It's just it's a privilege to be on your podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, sir. So tell me about somebody. I'd like to begin with you telling one who you are and your work and all those things about you.
Okay. My name is Glenn Wilson. I born and raised, born and raised to the age of 16 in Philadelphia. Went to Philadelphia schools. My mother and father moved. We moved in 1964 to the suburbs. So I graduated from Haverford High. I thought I could play basketball, so I wanted to go somewhere where I could play, and I went to Millersville in the 60s, and for a number of reasons, that did not work out. So I finished my undergrad work at Cheney, the oldest. Let me get that in there. Because of Vietnam, one way to just avoid being drafted was to teach elementary school. So I taught elementary school. I was a teacher in various school districts for about 17 years. After the death of both my parents, what I was trying to hide, my active addiction took over. And so I wasn't working until I got clean and came to my faith in 1993, and I've been working in the social service world since then. Primarily since 2000, I've been working in child welfare, 13 years with DHS, primarily being an investigator of sex abuse allegations. And for the last 8 years, I've been working at the Philadelphia Children's Alliance. I'm a family advocate. We interview children, our agency interviews children who have been sexually abused or there are allegations of sexual abuse. We are co-located with Police Special Victims Unit and DHS. We provide the interviewer and the interview space so that both DHS and the Special Victims Unit can hear the child interviewed one time. Scientists say that each time a child is interviewed, they relive the trauma. So anytime, any way possible to cut down the number of interviews is good. So I've been doing that for the last 8 years. Since 2003, I've been an associate minister at Enon Tabernacle Baptist Church. I served up to the pandemic. I served as a minister going into various correctional institutions, doing either worship service or Bible study. Currently, because of the pandemic, that I have not been in since, I guess, March of 19, is it? Or March of 20?
March of 20, I believe.
March of 20, yeah. I haven't been in, and I haven't heard anything about when visits for ministry are going to resume. So that's I could go on. I've done some other things, but that's a start.
Okay. No, I think it's, yeah, that's an amazing start. I tell you, you have done some work. And I guess I'll probably go back for a second. I think you mentioned going to Millersville, then you went to Cheney, which is Otis HBCU. I'm also an HBCU grad. My undergrad degree is from Fayetteville State University.
Oh, okay.
Undergrad in criminal justice there. And you also talked about you taught for some period of time in elementary schools throughout the area, I believe. Yeah. And how was that experience for you teaching during that time?
Well, it was interesting. I taught in the suburbs. I taught in Abington School District. Taught in two elementary schools there for 8 years. And because of the substance use, I know, looking back, I know now I did not live up to the responsibility that was afforded to me in terms of being a Black male in a school system, in an elementary school system. Although I still, because of social media, I'm still in touch with some former students, and I had an impact. But knowing what I know now, that is one. If there was a do-over, that's part of my life that I would certainly do over.
And you mentioned your addiction during this time. Can you want to share a little bit about that for us? Like how did it impact you overall, I guess? And I guess you say your parents didn't know, so you kept it from them in a way, but it seemed to show up in your...
Yeah. I can still remember the first beer I drank, trying to be accepted and thought to be cool by my next door neighbor, who was a little older than I was. He was in college and I was in 11th grade. And that started me along the road of that. Alcohol was the first substance. And then it turned into alcohol and marijuana. And then I discovered these books by Richard Beck, better known as Iceberg Slim. And I read those books, and he talked about a world that I knew absolutely nothing about. But I thought he was the coolest guy. And looking back, one of the reasons was that I just did not have exposure to Black authors back in the 60s. I'm not saying they weren't out there, but I didn't have exposure to them. Mm-hmm. But when I found him and he talked about a world that he knew, that just made me want to be like that. And along the way, the substances became available, and you can't win. At least, no, I didn't win. I was able to have a job for years, but unlike many teachers from my era at Cheney, who did 25 or 30 years in one school district and some in one school, I taught in the suburbs, I taught in Philadelphia, I taught in Camden, and I taught in Atlantic City. All of the reasons why I left the various assignments really is all connected to bad decision making and or my addiction. or my youth, and at the end of the road for me, it's kind of funny. The old Atlantic City High School was at Albany and Atlantic, and you could, from one door, you could almost throw a stone to the beach. Huh. And I remember telling myself, you know, there's no place further east I can go to teach. And that prophecy was fulfilled because I messed it up. I messed the job up because of attendance and stuff like that. So, yeah, but thank God for his grace and mercy, because like the prodigal son, I had to fall where I had to fall till I came to myself. And that's when I came to my faith and got clean and really, I don't know how specific you want me to get, Doc, but you know, the Lord.
It's up to you. What are you comfortable sharing? It's up to you.
The Lord has been leading me since then in terms of jobs and which jobs, and it's just been an awesome journey since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, I would just say that I thank you for sharing that detail about your life and the journey. And I think when you we think about addiction and some of those journeys that it takes people on, I think being able to look at how people can come back around and do things over. But I guess for you, you had to find a way where enough was enough for you, sounds like. And you knew when I need to stop this life because it wasn't getting me where I needed to be.
Well, I wound up figuratively in the gutter, Dr. Taylor. I was here's a guy with a college degree. My father actually, when I was at Cheney, he actually became president of Cheney. So the son of a college president and a elementary school teacher with a degree, fully certified teacher, wound up homeless at the age of 45. But that's what it took for me to come to myself and realize that my way was not working.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. So as you were saying earlier, like your faith in God and God bringing you through and leading you to different job assignments, do you feel like the journey you own now is God inspired, God led to where you are today?
Oh, absolutely. Let me go back a little further. I went, I worked with juvenile delinquents, was my first full-time job in recovery. That happened to be right across the street from where I was going to my outpatient. So I would stop in there more than I was supposed to. And my counselor said, well, you come over here all the time. Why don't you apply? So I did that. So I did DNA counseling, and everybody in recovery, not everybody, a lot of people in recovery want to be a DNA counselor. So I did that for a little while. A job opened up at the University of Penn. I worked for a PhD from Penn and a PhD from Bryn Mawr. Both of them, the PhD from Penn was working really in HIV research, but his area was risk behaviors in people that inject drugs. And the PhD I worked with at Bryn Mawr was working on women who trade sex for drugs or sex for money for drugs. So in that, my coworkers and I, it was a longitudinal study. Both of them were longitudinal. So we had to have relationships with the clients so that we could get them back in certain windows to interview them. And although we were trained to be flat and neutral during the interview questions sometimes served as an intervention And so then we would do some crisis social work, I called it, taking them around to try to access services while they were wanting services. And then my next door neighbor brought home some city jobs who she thought was for my daughter, but I saw one in there for DHS. And I said, well, I'm doing some like social work stuff now, because that's the job title, social worker. So I got in the DHS and I was sent to investigations, and that was a blessing, because that a lot of people can't do that, especially when I got into sex abuse investigations. Some people can't handle that, but I saw it as a ministry because I had to do the work, and I wasn't evangelizing, Dr. Taylor, but there is a way to be there for parents who a lot of times are just being told that their child was sexually abused.
Right.
And if DHS is involved, that means that they knew or they know the accuser.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So I just viewed that as a ministry because for numbers of reasons, in terms of who gets reported, many of the mothers that I dealt with didn't have a strong male figure in their circle, and for a brief period of time I became that guy. So to help them get through the initial initial time of understanding that something had happened, and to make sure that the system that I was working for did not swallow them up, or their misconceptions about the system that I worked for did not get them further entangled in that system.
Yeah, because I can imagine that is really complicated to deal with sexual assault. B, I guess, navigating the system, as I worked in the system for some time, it can be very intimidating and difficult to navigate. And so I guess your being there for these parents offered them, in some ways, sounds like to me, a navigational tool as well as an emotional support to understand some of the mechanisms around them in a way?
Yes.
Okay.
When you really look at it, you can't go into a situation and have a preconceived notion about how somebody is going to respond to whatever information you give them.
Right.
Unfortunately, because of a whole lot of inside stuff in the workers, if you don't respond the way that they want you to respond, then that can set up you getting into a system that really you don't have to get into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, to be quite honest, I thought of myself in a way as the spook that sat by the door, the book about the black CIA guy was kind of sized, but what he did was he got all the information from inside the system and then helped people use it to their best interest. And that's how I looked at it.
Yeah, that's really, I think it's important to be, I think it's important to be in position. And then when you were in the position, what are we doing in that space that we occupy, right? Exactly. Helping other people, assigned to me, you use that space for yourself as a tool for you, but also to help other people who are involved in the system to work their way through it. So as you think about your life, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Doc.
Okay. So as you think about your life in context of, you know, schooling, and now we're in 2022, how will you say the impact of your race as a Black man in America has impacted your processes?
Well, I can show you how much things have changed. I can still name you the five or six guys, Black guys, that were on African Americans. There were some Africans on, but I can still name for you the five or six Black African American guys that were on Millersville campus when I was there in 65. And that was culture shock to me, although when I went to Overbrook, when I went to elementary school and junior high school, I don't remember any white students in elementary school. There may have been a couple in junior high. When I got to Overbrook, Winfield was still predominantly Jewish. So there was, and I experienced this in my teaching. Winfield was predominantly Jewish. So on paper, Overbrook was integrated. But if you peel back the onion, so to speak, and you look at who's taking what classes, you will find that there wasn't as much interaction as you might anticipate if you had, you know, Pollyanna rose-colored glasses on. Here's an example. When I was in Overbrook, that was before Philadelphia School District gave people before Jewish holidays were a system-wide holiday. So depending on what class you took, you might have a free day in school, depending on how many Jewish kids were in your class. That, anecdotally looking at it, that translated to college prep. So I found out when I transferred from Overbrook to Haverford, I experienced an attempt to limit a Black kid from going into college prep. Here's what happened. I was in the academic course or college prep, whatever, however you want to characterize it, at Overbrook. In 11th grade, my parents moved. So my father took me to Haverford High School, and we went to the counselor's office to enroll me. The white counselor said, young man, what classes did you have? And I said, whatever the 11th grade classes were, I think like chemistry, algebra 2, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, well, what school are you coming from? I said, Overbrook. He said, well, you know, this is the suburbs, young man. Maybe you should think about taking general courses.
Really?
My father, who had an earned PhD from, or EDD rather, from NYU, didn't say a word. He just took out his business card, slid it across to the counselor. Counselor saw my father's business card and turned beet red.
Oh my goodness.
My father said, if he's going to fail, let him fail in academic. And that was the end of that conversation. The next year, as we were heading toward graduation, there were 6 out of 600 of my graduating class that were Black. A young lady said, who I know, Dr. Taylor, there's no doubt in my mind, she could have done well in college. She mm-hmm. went to the counselor's office and said, look, I want to take college prep or something like that, so I can go to college. I forget how she phrased it. Mm-hmm. They told her, you can do that, but you won't be able to walk in June. And in the 60s, there was no, like, not graduating with your class. That was that just didn't happen. So she was dissuaded from going on to college prep. So
that's amazing, right? When you think about like in how education is the is the gateway oftentimes, you know, to different life choices, careers, jobs, and I guess and to be denied at the door happens now, I know as well, but you know, to be denied in that space can be very devastating.
Well, absolutely. As a professional, I saw it sitting around. I saw this dynamic, and I have another anecdote too. I saw this as a professional and a family participant in IEP meetings, where you know, for special ed kids, you have to have the IEP meeting every year. And usually the parent is the only non-professional around, sitting around the table.
Yeah.
And what happens all too often, and even if I take the high road and say accidentally, what happens all too often is the professionals lapse into educational jargon, educationalese, acronyms, and the like. And then they ask this parent, do you understand what we're talking about before you sign your name?
Right.
Most adults in that setting are too intimidated to say, not really.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, depending on the level of exceptionality, I'm still not sure if these kids are getting high school diplomas. But here's my anecdote, Dr. Taylor.
Okay.
We have a disabled grandson who is God's gift to us for sure. But my daughter asked me to come to an IEP meeting, and I felt like I was going to test out my anecdotal theory.
Uh-huh.
So I put on my nice blue button-down shirt, Ivy League shirt and tie, and I had a nice fresh pair of khakis on.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my business cards from my job, and I went to the IEP, passed them around. And so the facilitator said, okay, we're going to go around and introduce ourselves. And when they got to me, I said, my name is Glenn Wilson. I'm Darian's grandfather. And their mouths dropped. And one of them even said, I thought you were on the team. So what does that say about preconceived notions about who's sitting around the table?
Right. That's powerful, isn't it? Just like the idea of like, yeah. So how did it feel for you now? What did you, I guess, what was your emotional moment? What did you feel in that moment, I guess, well, emotionally?
I've done that. The same guy, he had, my daughter said, could you come with us to, he had a neurological appointment at St. Chris. Well, I was, because of my work, I was friends with the head of social work at St. Chris at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked her, could I call you and you join me? I want you to meet my daughter so that if she has any problems going forward, she can just call you. Not a problem. When this lady came to the appointment and sat down with us, this, you could see the eyebrows raised behind the desk in terms of who are these people that she would come and sit with them instead of, you mean he's not just, I'll use the pejorative, he's just not the regular Negroes we get in here? No.
Mm-hmm.
No, no. Mm-hmm. And these kind, they, you know, now they're called microaggressions.
Right, right.
And white folk will never understand that we just last week, I was talking to one of my buddies in Uncle Bobby's.
Mm-hmm. Great bookstore, by the way.
Great bookstore.
Yeah.
He's at his computer and we're chit-chatting. And this white woman comes up and says, can you check me out?
Oh. No,
we don't work here. No. I mean, and I guarantee you, Dr. Taylor, she would describe herself as either a progressive or a liberal. I mean, because after all, she was in Uncle Bobby's.
Right.
So these are the kinds of things that black folk deal with and put up with sometime on a daily basis.
On a regular. It happens quite frequently.
Definitely on the regular.
Right. And I guess that when you, and when these microaggressions happen, or when these moments of racism, discrimination happen, do you find that you have to be aware of how you respond to these things, or do you choose at times not to respond because of how it can be perceived as an angry black man responding?
If we're going to be impactful in the moment, if we're going to cause the person who committed the microaggression or the subtle racism, or at least at the very least the racially insensitive comment, we have to be aware of how we respond. Otherwise, we will be written off as just another angry black man or woman. At least that's the way I see it.
But you know, I think part of that too is does it own us to have to respond in a certain way when we are being disrespected?
Oh, absolutely. It's the same way as I'm sure this has happened to you. I am on my job. There has been another black guy. He was there on the job temporarily for a little while. But for the last 8 years, I've been the only black guy on my job.
Yep, been there.
And I'm sure you've experienced when somebody says something that everybody that knows you know rubbed you the wrong way.
Yes.
And then the whole room looks at you to see how you're going to react.
Yes.
Respond.
Respond, right.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another thing that those of us who are in certain positions have to, that's added responsibility to us, even though it shouldn't be,
right.
Responding for a whole race.
Right. Because it is true, the way you respond in those moments, they look at, and which is, I think, the pressure a lot of black men carry is how I show up here, how I respond here. It's not just about me, but they look at other black folks who look like me in this way.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
But I choose to respond, Minister Glenn, in those moments. You know, I'm like, I'm not having this way. So I choose to make a statement in those cases. I think it's important that people who commit microaggressions are called upon on those things.
Yeah. Here's one for you, Doc. At DHS, you know, part of the job is having to go to family court. If you can't resolve it yourself, sometimes you have to take clients to court. So you get at least familiar with the cast of characters over there in terms of child advocate attorneys, parent attorneys, court personnel. Mm-hmm. Well, because of my work at Penn, I got invited, my wife and I got invited to a fundraiser for Prevention Point, a needle exchange agency.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the event, the only way I forget the name of the movie. Do you remember the scene where the little boy said, I see dead people?
Was that Sixth Sense?
Sixth Sense, yes.
Yes.
Part of that was filmed in South Philly, like off of Grace Ferry. There's like a neat little block down there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's where the event was held.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in there, with my wife, and we're, you know, chit-chatting with the lady that invited, with the PhD from Bryn Mawr that invited us. And in comes a lawyer that I knew, at least by sight, from family court. Here's the first thing out of her mouth when she saw me. How did you get here?
Yeah, wow.
My response was, by car. How did you get here?
That's a fantastic response.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing out of her mouth. Yeah.
Isn't that like one of those things where it's almost, I'm surprised to see, I mean, I know how I'm here, but I'm surprised to see you here. How are you in the same room I'm in?
She might as well have said that very thing.
Just said that. Yeah.
What the hell are you doing in the place where I'm invited to? And that just speaks to how people pigeonhole and categorize us. They broad brushing all DHS workers, at the most broad brushing Black folk in general.
Yeah, and I think when you look at that, that perception that we are somewhat is painted with this brush, that we should be in this space, all these things that people sometimes say about us as Black people, Black men. How do you feel like your ministry or being a minister in your impacts your work? And is that a different layer for you? And how you're seen by people?
Well, not so much the minister, but one thing I realized is that, for example, anytime DHS knocks on somebody's door, it's not a good day. Mm-hmm. All of us, there are times in where we live where if somebody busted in on us, it would not be us at our best.
Yes.
And with that, and I also have to remember where I came from. So I say that to say that everybody, or it was my intention, and it still is my intention, everybody gets a clean slate when I begin my interaction with them. I must not prejudge anybody based on looks, allegations that are contained in the report, none of that. Because, I mean, sex abuse allegations, as we now know, Jeffrey Epstein is sex abuse allegations to the nth degree, but that cuts across every single demographic in the United States.
Yep.
An interesting part of my work was I was at a seminar conducted by CHOP, really. And the doctor that's in charge of the clinic where they do a lot of abuse work said that she couldn't estimate how much underreporting abuse there is.
Yeah.
And that speaks to systems in the United States where those. And I mean, my summer reading included Cast.
Great book.
Yes, yes. Just Mercy. And there's this pushing down from above on us in the lower strata of life in the United States. What we as Black people cannot forget, even though we are not monolithic. And even though some of us work in the system, we cannot be forgetful of the fact that that tons of money is generated by what the system does to those at the bottom. I mean, you look at child welfare, mental health, prison, police, court, all those systems all survive off of money from basically the lower strata of society in my job in Philadelphia. And who makes up the lower strata? Black and brown people, for the most part.
Right. No, I think that's really, really interesting. So when you think about like how those systems are, as we think about the systems of failure, right? Mental health, criminal justice, educational systems have failed Black people, Black men. How do you feel like the police and police interactions with Black men has continued to do that same system of pushing people down?
Well, I look at it, Doc, in any bureaucracy, you can rank order the workers in that bureaucracy, from best to worst. Then you add a layer of systemic racism, and it's not my quote, but I use it all the time. Understanding that racism has infected and affected every aspect of life in America.
Yeah.
So, and add to that how, just like in the educational system, you have teachers who have, outside of their school where they work, they have little to no interaction with Black people. The same is true with police. Now, one of the buzzwords in social work now, or counseling now, is the TF, trauma focused CF, CBT, trauma focused TFCBT, cognitive behavior therapy. That's the new certificate that makes you a more valued therapist.
Yeah, I've been noticing that a lot coming through. Yeah.
But here's the conundrum. In my mind, having that certificate does not trump, pun intended, cultural competence.
True.
So expand that concept.
Right.
So go through the police academy. You can go through any undergrad school, complete the coursework, go get a job, and your job is in the inner city. But you have had little to no interaction with Black folk in your entire life. And then if you filter out those encounters where the Black or brown persons that you engaged with were a absolute distinct minority, that renders almost your interactions with Black and brown people useless, because now you're thrown into a situation where you are, yes, you have a job as an authority figure, but you are a distinct minority. You are the minority, and you're going into a different culture. That you have no understanding of, and And what happens a great deal is, out of fear, in my opinion, at worst fear, and at best a misunderstanding of culture, you have some bad interactions between police and black folk. Now, I say that because I'm also a police chaplain.
Right.
Let me start with the guy who had his knee on George Floyd's neck.
Mm-hmm. Derek Chauvin.
Derek Chauvin, murder.
Yeah.
The policeman who shot Philando Castile, murder. The woman who, I think during the pandemic, she said she was reaching for her taser and shot the boy in the car, murder.
Yes.
The officer down in Oklahoma who killed the boy because she said she thought she was in her own apartment, murder.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in Philadelphia, and I'm sure nationwide, is the police union protects not necessarily that egregious behavior, but less than murder egregious behavior all too often. All too often. So there is an issue with policing in the black community, but to balance that, let me suggest this. I work closely with special victims officers and detectives. And what do you do when you find out that your daughter, your niece, your granddaughter, your sister was abused by some boy or some man? You want that guy arrested.
Right.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. So I have a counterweight. I have a counterweight to what goes on. And yes, there definitely is police brutality. But to answer one of your questions, the counter to that is we have to understand, especially as black men, that what we want to do if we're stopped is to have that stop, whether it's on foot or in a car, to get past that stop.
Right.
That means that certain behavior is called for. Now, Philando Castile did that and he still got killed.
Yes.
But for the most part, certain behavior in that situation is called for. I'm sure they did it at Fayetteville State, Dr. Taylor, but at Cheney, part of the unofficial curriculum was learning how to code switch, meaning that your behavior and language, you have to have the ability to change your behavior and language according to the situation you are in if you want to get out of it with the best results.
Right, yeah, I've heard that, right? In so many conversations, code switching is used a lot. And one thing that I would say is, like, you know, a lot of young men in my research work have indicated their parents told them about the talk when the police stop you, the things that you need to do. And we know a lot of black men have done those things, and yet they still have not been, they didn't survive, and they may have been by the police pulled out of the car and abused, right? So I think when we think about code switching and how we show up in those places, it's also about the responsibility of the other person to give us respect, right? I understand the power dynamic there, but still, I think respect is important in these spaces.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And part of what's going on now in policing is that it's hard to find, they're not getting many applicants. So,
well, you know, the city of Philadelphia recently allowed police to not have to live in the city anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
To get more police to work on the police force.
What's happening is a lot of officers are coming, a lot of people are coming from the suburbs. They go to the police academy here, put in a certain amount of time on the streets of Philadelphia, and then they take that training credential, really, that policing credential. I went through the Philadelphia Police Academy, and for example, I spent the last 3 years working in the 19th district, which is West Philadelphia. Then they go apply to some suburban district, and they're going to be sopped up real quick.
Yeah, but I think it's problem. I think it's problematic to not have to live in the community where you work if you're a policeman, because you're not going to get to know the people in the community. You're not going to be invested in the city in the same way, because you can go back home to your suburb, wherever you live outside the city. So I think that's going to be a problem we're going to see.
Yeah,
that's going to come down eventually once this process gets more.
Let me push back a little bit on that, Dr. Taylor.
Okay.
For example, I live in the 19th district, which is let's give me 52nd Street to City Line. Let's say Market to the expressway.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if I would make it necessary for all of my officers to live inside the 19th district.
Okay.
Inside Philadelphia, I can agree with for tax revenue purposes.
Okay.
But I wouldn't push it as where they are assigned that they
have. Gotcha. I can hear that. I can understand that. That makes sense.
Okay.
And so I know we're wrapping our time up here. I could talk to you all day. I mean, there's so many layers we haven't gotten to yet.
Yeah.
Right? But I think like we look at like policing, and I think, and I guess one more question about the police. What's your view on community policing? Like, you know, we have like, there was an event recently, National Night Out, where police go to communities and have games with people, basketball games and all that stuff to enhance community presence. Do you think as your work, have you seen that to be effective?
Well, here's the thing, and I understand the thought that if you can't measure it, you can't analyze it. But anecdotally speaking, from years of teaching, what I see is there are, regardless of the school, there's some kids that you don't have to worry about. They're going to be on track. They're going to do the thing. There are some kids who you have to watch. But just like the bell curve, there's a whole lot of kids in the middle. What they are looking at is how, when somebody does something that everybody knows is wrong, what happens to that person? And I think that is where the system falls short, or this whole dynamic now, get rid of cash bail and all. No, for some things, for some accusations, some people have to be locked up, in my opinion. There is a crew, I think, that the various programs that are coming out now. My area is, I'm old, so, but I still claim sports to be my area.
so there's... You're too old for sports, Mr. Glenn.
Yeah, and you know, the older I get, the better I used to be. That's what I say. The sports grab a lot of kids, or
right.
Kids. Then there's any other initiative you can come up with will grab some kids. And if there's a police presence there, that at least can do battle with the narrative that Well, let's be honest. Social media and the entertainment industry always puts this this very negative connotation on police. So anything that can humanize the police is good, because once again, when something goes down, you're not gonna call Ghostbusters, you're gonna call the police.
Right. And have you familiar with the show Queen Sugar by any chance?
Yes.
Are you familiar with last episode? And now those who haven't watched the episode, I'm sorry, I gotta make this point. Nova is trying to defund the police, but then as she was given that COVID vaccine, she had to call the police to help control the crowd. And they had the idea, like, she didn't want to call them, but she knew they would help her control the crowd. So it's kind of like, how do we balance these two things out in a way, all right? So kind of have both and both views present.
Yeah, no. There used to be a unit called the Civil Affairs Unit. And they were the ones that would come out, and they knew how to diffuse. Now, of course, this is in the late 50s and the 60s and early 70s. They knew how to diffuse tense situations. I remember when Dr. King was killed. There was a shoe store at 52nd and Chestnut, and it went up in flames, and everybody thought that was a response to the killing of Dr. King. Turned out it was just covering up a burglary, but they had people from the Civil Affairs Unit out there, they were plainclothes police presence, but they were trained in how to interact with crowds.
I think that's it is fair, and I think we're looking at how do we process that system in a way. You know, I worked 20 years in the criminal justice system, so I think understanding all those dynamics and having people who can come out and defuse situations. But as our time is winding down, I'm gonna have to have you back for part two, because there's more I want to discuss with you that we haven't gotten to today.
Okay. I think one of the major problems is language, Dr. Ted.
Okay.
I think that phrase "defund the police" caught on, and you know, especially people in my age bracket. No, man. I'm 74. I want to be able to walk to the store if I feel like walking to the store. I want to be able to drive my car that I worked for without worrying about being carjacked. So we need some policing. Now, let's define what that looks like. Let's not say defund the police.
Right. And I think that when people who have said defund the police, when you pull that back more or dig deeper into it, is looking at how do we defund some of the funding that police receive and put that money in other community organizations, get that money into nonprofit groups that are working to combat community violence. Like, are we taking that money and put it into our school systems? Like, I think, like, because the police budgets, you know, are pretty robust in most cities, right? Mm-hmm. States.
Mm-hmm.
So can we take some money that police are getting for military, like to buy tanks and AR-57, whatever they're shooting with these days.
Yeah.
Can we take some of that money and give it to the community to help rebuild some of these playgrounds? And I think, and that's what defund the police looks like. I think the reallocation of funding that the police receive.
Oh, I agree with all that. But see, that's the problem with some of these hashtags.
It's not explained in the hashtag.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. We got to explain what the... I think if people had a clearer view of what some of these statements mean, like, as opposed to looking at a hashtag or getting a brief view of something, really digging deep into what it really means, I think we will see a different response to some of the things that we're talking about.
Oh, I agree with that. And you know, that speaks to that. That just speaks to this whole tweet thing where people speak in tweets, and some of these complex issues cannot be explained away in 200 words or less.
No, I think context matters.
Absolutely.
And I say to my clients all the time, you can say something to someone in 2 words or you can use 20 words. I think the more you say, the better.
Oh, yeah.
Because it allows people to have a fuller understanding of what's really, really going on. So what is one thing you want people to know, take away from this conversation about the lives and voices of Black men?
Well, what I like to say is that we're not monolithic. There are Black men who are stand-up guys by any measure you choose to use. There are strong Black men who are committed to family and living a life that is examinable, if that's a word, that can stand the critique of people looking at the lives. There are just hordes of Black men who are upright doing the doggone thing. But of course, we don't get the publicity for just doing the right thing. I mean, right. The media would rather cover Meek Mill getting a helicopter ride from jail to the Sixer game so he could ring the bell before the game.
Yeah.
And that example, what I'm saying is, are you telling me, 76er brass, that there is not one other Black man in the Philadelphia area that deserves to be able to ring that bell other than Meek Mill? And of course the answer is there are thousands.
Right. I think that's the thing, is important to look at how Black men vary, not monolithic, but like sexuality, all of those things, that how do we show up in places, and how are we going to be, like, you know, looking at Black men, not just those that are, you know, maybe going to jail in some cases, because it's not all of us are going to jail, but also looking at how are we holding other Black men who are doing things in the community that's different. And are we shining the spotlight on other people, right? And being able to look at all Black men and put them in the front of these conversations every single day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got to tell you, Minister Glenn, I really enjoyed talking to you today, and I really want to bring you back.
It would be my pleasure.
To talk more, because we have more we have to dig into about just life. I want to talk about sexuality and religion maybe at some point with you.
Oh, absolutely.
And also maybe looking into, again, just looking at how education in some cases hinders the growth of Black boys, because oftentimes people don't understand how Black boys learn, and so they are shut out of the conversation of learning.
Yeah, I mean, that's very important. Because elementary school is set up, in my opinion, for girls. Now, that's sexist sounding, but boys learn differently and they are behind. But once again, Black boys are ripe, and not just Black boys, Black families are ripe for the sacrificing of their boys for the sake of an SSI check. And with that comes with certain diagnoses. But what you're doing is sacrificing 18 years of a child's life for a check. Now,
Okay. All right. Okay. We got. We really got to get into that. because we hear a lot about black boys being diagnosed with ADHD, right? Because they won't sit still in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, that's not what's going on with them. They're not being stimulated to learn, right?
Right.
And so, what I want to do is put a pin there for our next conversation. We'll start there. Black boys in the education system.
Oh, man.
And SSDI checks. I think that's a good place to start.
Okay.
So, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to part two.
Thank you so much, Dr. Taylor. As I say, it's a privilege to be on your podcast. And my hope is that, you know, the half concerning you has not yet been told.
Amen to that, my brother. Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
All right. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you. God bless you.